Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. This hour on the program, Russia has recognized the Georgian regions of South Ossetia and Abkhazia as independent and continues to occupy them with troops. The United States and European allies say this is not acceptable. In Iraq, in Anbar province, terrorist attacks have decreased by 90%, and American troops have handed over control to Iraqi security forces. Meanwhile, Israeli President Shimon Peres has warned Prime Minister Ehud Olmert that a military attack on Iran's nuclear facilities could provoke a broader conflict. These are among the opportunities and challenges for U.S. foreign and security policy that we'll discuss this hour in Iraq and Russia and the Middle East with my guests. Karen DeWisha is professor of political science at Miami University here in Ohio and director of the university's Habinghurst Center for Russian and Post-Soviet Studies. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
And joining us, her husband, Adid DeWisha, is professor of political science at Miami University. His most recent book, Arab Nationalism in the 20th Century, From Triumph to Despair. Welcome back, Adid DeWisha.
Good morning.
We're at 614-292-8513, and you can email comments or questions to openline@wosu.org. Well, you know, Russia indeed continues to recognize these regions of the independent nation of Georgia as independent and continues to occupy them. And the New York Times report this morning that the Bush administration has decided not to take direct punitive action against Russia because of this conflict, but is willing to work in a more gradual way with its European allies. Karen, one question I have about this is, who started the armed conflict? Did Russia start it, or was it the Georgian president, Saakashvili, who made the first move militarily?
Well, the Ossetian militia and the Georgian residents of Ossetia had been exchanging fire all over the summer. Mm-hmm. And on the fateful day, Georgian missile batteries fired into the capital of Ossetia, Skhinvali, mm-hmm. and precipitated a Russian response, armed response, into Ossetia. So when we, you know, are going to write the history of this, that's going to be a major starting point. Mm-hmm. Having said that, there's a lot of evidence that suggests that Russian troops were massed on the border. They had been engaged in a military set of military maneuvers called Kavkaz 2008 that had put those troops there, and they had not been demobilized after the exercises ended on August 2nd. So it looks like, you know, both sides were operating on trigger wires and each trying to get the other to go first so that international public opinion would be in their favor. But I think we have to say that if we want to be, you know, very precise, the Georgians did violate international ceasefire terms.
Mm-hmm. That's what Mikhail Gorbachev said in an article for the New York Times. He said, look, you're blaming Russia, the international community, for this, but really it was Georgia that he said that made the first move.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Well, why this big uproar over these Georgian territories, if we can call them that, of Ossetia and Abkhazia? I mean, why isn't this something that could have been negotiated out between Georgia and Russia?
Yes, absolutely. And there had been a conflict, a low-level conflict, and even very hot periods of civil war inside Georgia since the early 1990s. And the Organization for Security Cooperation in Europe had been involved in negotiating ceasefire. And actually, under the terms of that ceasefire, Russian troops were in Ossetia and in Abkhazia as peacekeepers, internationally sanctioned by OSCE. Mm-hmm. And one of the big problems that the Russians always point to is that when these missiles slammed into the capital of Ossetia, they killed some Russian peacekeepers too, mm-hmm. As well as Ossetians and actually as well as Georgian civilians. So there should have been a possibility for negotiation, but there's very, very bad personal relations between the president of Georgia and, in particular, Prime Minister Putin. And they're really not on friendly speaking terms. Relations had really deteriorated between them. And I was in Russia for the entire month of July. And it was really very evident from simply watching TV and talking to officials that something pretty serious was brewing. There was a real war pitch. They were really preparing the Russian population for, you know, dehumanizing Georgians, mm-hmm. seeing the regime there as in a very negative light.
Mm-hmm. Adida, there's been some reporting here in the United States, too, that our State Department and Defense Department are not terribly happy with the president of Georgia, Saakashvili, that indeed they see him as a bit of a wild card, as someone who maybe has been a bit provocative in ways that they would wish he had not been.
Well, I don't want to intrude on that, on a conflict which Karen knows much more about, but certainly it's certainly true from the reports that I have read that he is supposed to be hot-headed, and that I mean, I think the point that Karen made about the relationship with Putin is absolutely crucial. Even though you have a democratic leader in Georgia and an authoritarian leader in Russia, personalities still continue to play an important role in conflicts like that outside Europe, outside Western Europe, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of reporting about him precipitating this through probably actions that would have been interpreted by Russia as provocative.
Well, Karen, I can understand what's at stake here for Georgia in the sense that the international community regards South Ossetia and Abkhazia as part of the independent nation of Georgia. So it's clear that it's recognized as their territory. But why does Russia have this strong interest in occupying those territories?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a really great question because, you know, the costs of occupation are very high for any state. And once, I think Colin Powell once says, once you own a China shop, if you break something, you've got to fix it. And so now they are going to have to pay the cost for rebuilding, you know, the devastated economies in both of these breakaway regions, as opposed to, you know, they're no longer going to be on the Georgian budget.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Russia has a lot of money. And in fact, one of the arguments that I heard a lot in Moscow is that they have so much money they don't know what to do with it. And the defense industrial complex there certainly has its hands out and are feeding a sense of renewed nationalism, a kind of ultra-nationalism even beyond the normal bounds of patriotism. I think that as often happens, leaders in Russia feel that the 90s and even the first Putin term as president up until 2004, Russia was included in the international system, included in the G8, you know, more or less as a favor. It was weak. It was told what to do. It was told how to build a democracy. It was told how to structure its economy. And now, as a result, largely of the increase in gas and oil prices, Russia is back. And they don't want to be pushed around. So they see this as a signal of their new assertiveness more generally.
Mm-hmm.
So Georgia for them is really small potatoes. And, I mean, you know, Skhinvali is the size of small Oxford, Ohio.
Yeah.
It's a very small place. So, rebuilding infrastructure is not going to be that difficult for them. But I think that they did not imagine that it would have the international repercussions that it has.
Although now that they've declared or recognized those territories as independent, South Ossetia and Abkhazia, there's not a great deal that the U.S. can do about this, is there? And the international community.
Well, Georgia will certainly take, they announced today that they're going to take the Russian occupation of territory to the international court.
Mm-hmm.
And one can imagine that Georgia will receive favorable hearings in such international enclaves. But, you know, as we've seen with many other cases of frozen conflicts, you can keep the public opinion on your side, but it's not necessarily going to change the situation on the ground for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Fred.
Yes,
I do. Just kind of to put in my 10 cents here, I just, you know, this whole thing reminds me, and I think Karen is kind of thinking about that in terms of some future research. But if you look at the situation now in terms of Russia, it really is very reminiscent of the Second World War, or at least before the Second World War, the era between 1929 and 1939. Germany was also pushed around, kicked around, told what to do. Then you have a very strong authoritarian leader who, in a sense, reclaims Germany's power and Germany's honor, and begins to encroach on contiguous states. And the debate in the 1930s was, is Hitler simply a nationalist who really wants to bring back to Germany what it had, what it was its due, and which was taken from it by the Allies who defeated it in the First World War, or is he going to go beyond those limits? I mean, the first scenario was acceptable to many people, as long as he behaves himself and works within these limits and sort of says that these are areas that that should be liberated and so on. That was fine, but the others saw far greater aggressiveness in what Germany was doing, and we know what happened. And I mean, I think now we have to kind of figure out what are the intentions of Russia, mm-hmm. and how far it is prepared to go. Is Georgia going to be the end, or is it going to make demands on Ukraine, which has a substantial Russian population, and other countries? And indeed, I mean, I think maybe we don't want to go too far with that, but we can also ask whether some of the Russian leaders want to revive the Soviet Union.
Well, you know, I do hear the words Cold War being used again. Any chance of a revival of the Cold War?
Absolutely. I mean, the President Medvedev said this week, it's not even Prime Minister Putin, but Medvedev said that they don't want a revival of the Cold War, but if it happens, they'll survive. Hmm. And I think that they feel, wrongly in my opinion, but they feel that their economic position vis-a-vis Europe, in terms of the supply of a vast proportion of Europe's oil and gas, will serve certain strategic goals that will serve them well, in that they will divide Europe, which is always a contest between Russia and the United States for the loyalty of Europe, for the unity or disunity of Europe. And the money will flow in. People will have to pay the going rate for Russia's energy.
Does Russia have such control over European energy supplies that it can, you know, push or pressure certain European Union policies?
Well, in the case of Germany, for example, they provide 30% of German oil and gas. But there are other countries, including some of the new European EU members like Lithuania and Czech Republic and Poland, where the figure is above 70%. Now, it's interesting that Germany has been quieter than Lithuania, Poland, and Czech Republic in criticizing Russia for these actions. So even though they are more dependent, they also regard their, you know, their identity, their newfound independence, their democracies, their strategic security as being more emboldened by this, and are really mobilized and are speaking out against Russia.
At least one U.S. commentator has suggested that the United States has been unnecessarily provocative in terms of Russia by talking about the entrance into NATO of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization of Georgia and the Ukraine, and the suggestion that, you know, that really is unnecessary and that Russia feels very threatened by this.
Yeah, I agree. I think Russia is threatened by it. And in the 90s, the reaction of the Yeltsin regime was, well, if we don't approve of it, but we are entering into a close partnership with the West, and we're not going to employ countermeasures. When Putin came to power, his reaction initially was, we're not in favor of it. If you want to drain your economies by spending all this money on the military, we're going to put our economy on a fast track to recovery, so go ahead. But now it's gotten a little too close for comfort, and they are speaking out against it and saying that they will employ military countermeasures.
And then I guess there was this hastily concluded agreement for the positioning of anti-missile missiles in Poland. Allegedly, the idea of Poland and the United States is saying in case a rogue state like Iran launches missiles at Europe. But Russia seems threatened by that too.
Right, and because it's an anti-missile system, the radar is stationed in Czech Republic. The actual missile batteries would be in Poland, and it'll be there'll be a very quick reaction time. It'll be launch on warning, and local commanders will have ability to launch. They're very worried about that, and those missiles will be destroyed over potentially Russian territory, or at least over Ukraine and Belarus. And by the way, they also would destroy Russian missiles. I mean, they're not going to be able to tell the national identity of a missile.
Sure. What is this? Is this missile battery in Poland with the census, as you say, in the Czech Republic? Is that really necessary for the United States security?
Well, we're very worried about the situation in Iran, and, you know, Adid knows far more about that than I do. But a lot of our military posture is being pushed by our concern over Iranian intentions and in Iranian real capabilities as opposed to what they say they're capable of. And I suppose the function of our military establishment is to prepare for worst-case scenarios, and that's what they regard as part of the worst-case scenario planning.
So, Adid, in other words, there really is a fear on the part of our administration that Iran could conceivably launch missiles at our European allies, and therefore we better have this first line of defense, huh?
Well, I mean, I would have thought if Iran does produce some nuclear weapons and does have the delivery system that goes with it, I think, to be quite honest, Europe is not its first target. We should worry about Middle Eastern targets, particularly Israel, where the missiles will go first, if they really ever enact that. But and I'm not very clear in my own mind, to be quite honest, whether these missiles in Europe could in any way aid Israel in combating any attack by the Iranians. But there's, I mean, as Karen says, if you're a military planner, you don't plan for the best possible scenario. You plan for the worst possible scenario. When you have a government in Iran that is extremely unpredictable, it is divided at the top, with a president that continues to make provocative statements, that actually does create a sense of concern. And in a way, you have to prepare for what if he goes beyond his area of immediate concern, which is the Middle East, and goes beyond that. That is the to my mind the policy that in a way a military planner will pursue.
Adid, is there some question whether these missiles in fact can shoot down an incoming missile with any degree of accuracy?
You know, that I am not, it's not my area of expertise. I know that in the first Gulf War, they didn't perform that well. But I also have seen reports that since then they have improved considerably, and now they have a kind of an accuracy of 85% to 90%. But beyond that, to be quite honest, I can't tell you anymore.
Yeah. Israeli Prime Minister, or President, I should say, Shimon Peres, has warned Prime Minister Ehud Olmert that a military attack by Israel on Iran's nuclear facilities could provoke a broader conflict. What do we know? What is Israel considering here? Are they considering an air attack on Iran's installations?
Well, there was a statement by a minister to that effect, that they are planning for a kind of an attack on these nuclear facilities in Iran, which was then later denied, and this person was disciplined in some way or other. But I am convinced that this must be part of the planning. If we're saying that here in Europe we're so concerned that for the worst possible scenario that we are in fact creating a missile, an anti-missile system, then you can imagine what Israeli planners must feel when they're so near to Iran, and when they are in fact the target of the verbal onslaught of the Iranian president, who actually says that part of his policies is to eliminate the Israeli state. And so I would be surprised, knowing Israel's history in terms of its preemptive attacks that have occurred consistently over the last 50 years, that the Israelis are not planning something against Iran, especially if they begin to believe that the United States will not take a proactive stance here. In other words, the best scenario for the Israelis is the Americans attacking Iran. That completely takes them out of the picture. But if they feel that the Americans, with their commitment in Iraq, with their commitment, increasing commitment in Afghanistan, are not going to broaden the conflict to get involved in Iran, then I think planners in Israel are looking at the possibility of going it alone.
Mm-hmm. Do you see a military conflict, an air attack on Iran's nuclear installations as inevitable, or is there some way the international community can negotiate Iran out of the possibility of them having nuclear weapons?
I think to a large extent this whole thing depends on the kind of intelligence we have. Vis-a-vis the nuclear program in Iran, there's a lot of confusion at the moment as to where they are, and it varies from within 9 months to a year to 4 or 5 or 6 years. Once the intelligence comes up with reliable assessments that are supported by the UN bodies, that Iran is on the verge of producing nuclear weapons, I think, to be quite honest, the Israelis will probably act. I don't think the Israelis are going to sit back and just hope that the Iranians will not attack. Now, the Iranians may not attack. The Iranians may be simply using this as a threat to further their own interests and policies. But if I'm an Israeli prime minister or an Israeli cabinet member, I really would not sit around hoping that the Iranians will not do it. So that when we have reliable information and reliable intelligence assessments that it is really imminent, I think then it becomes inevitable. I cannot see the Israelis sitting back and hoping for the best.
All right. We're talking with Adid Dawisha and Karen Dawisha, professors of political science at Miami University in Oxford. And we're talking about challenges and opportunities for U.S. foreign and security policy. We're going to take a short break here and then back with my guests, and we'll take your phone calls at WOSU 820 NPR News.
Next time on Day to Day.
The parts were simple,
but they made them into some of the biggest hits of the 60s and 70s.
Meet the L.A. studio musicians known as the Wrecking Crew.
There may never, ever be a group of rock and roll musicians of that caliber again.
I'll just go into this.
A documentary on some of pop music's unsung heroes.
Next time on Day to Day.
Day to Day begins in 30 minutes. It starts at noon, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning. I'm Amy Jurevich. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. Hear today's big stories put in perspective on All Things Considered. Hosts Robert Siegel, Michelle Norris, Melissa Block, and WOSU's Christina Morgan present a mix of news, interviews, commentaries, reviews, and offbeat features. Listen to All Things Considered, weekdays starting at 4, now on WOSU 89.7 FM, NPR News, and classical music. In the weather forecast for today, cloudy this morning, rain off and on throughout the afternoon. There may be some sunshine that peaks through later this afternoon, a high around 72. For tonight, clear and chilly, a low of 48 tonight. On Wednesday, sunny and a high of 73. And on Thursday, partly sunny and a high around 80. Currently 61 degrees in downtown Columbus. Back to Open Line.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. We're talking about challenges for United States foreign policy, Russia, the Middle East, Iraq, we'll discuss in just a moment. Adeed Dawisha, professor of political science at Miami University here in Oxford, Ohio, joins us. His most recent book, Arab Nationalism in the 20th Century, From Triumph to Despair. And Karen Dawisha, professor of political science at Miami University and director of the university's Havighurst Center for Russian and Post-Soviet Studies. You can join us by telephone at 614-292-8513. You can email comments or questions to openline at wosu.org. So, Adeed, in other words, you're suggesting that if Iran continues its pursuit of nuclear weapons, as we assume they are pursuing them, and evidence has established that they indeed are very near to perfecting them and possessing them, that Israel will not be able to refrain from a military attack, that they will see this as essential to their security.
Absolutely correct. And that is not just a simple prognostication. I mean, it is based on Israel's history. Israel has consistently seen itself as a garrison state. It's a state that is surrounded by countries that are not particularly friendly to it. And they're very sensitive to verbal attacks on them. They tend to kind of see this, and they have historical evidence and data to back that up. That when people begin to verbally assault them at some point, these verbal assaults would be transferred and transformed into military attacks, or at least the effort to use military means to achieve these objectives. And the Israelis have never sat back and allowed their perceived enemies to begin. The only time they did that was in 1973, when they disregarded a lot of kind of data and evidence that the Egyptians and the Syrians were planning to attack. But at that time, the Israelis felt pretty dominant militarily in the area and thought that these guys would not do it. Well, that's the only time when they allowed their enemies or their perceived enemies to do that. And the result was the most difficult military confrontation the Israelis had in their history that thus far, mm-hmm. against the Arab states of those times.
So, given that is the case, that Israel's then would be very likely to attack. Mm-hmm. Iran must have a very, very strong motivation for pursuing nuclear weapons, given that they must understand the situation as well, or don't they believe Israel would attack?
Well, it's not very clear to me what their assessment is. I mean, I think it's kind of one have to look at this on multiple levels. First of all, Iran is a so-called revolutionary state. The idea of Islamic revolution permeates their thinking, and that kind of proclivity tends to kind of make Iran a bit more difficult to analyze, as if you kind of were looking at a traditional country, a traditional state. The second thing that one has to look at is that the diffusion of power at the very top and the competition between the leaders. you find that statements made up by Ahmadinejad, the president, would sometimes be contradicted by Ayatollah Khamenei, who was the top religious leader, and sometimes then at other times he would support him, and it's not very clear in that sense who is in charge or how policy will emerge from that kind of political structure. And it's not very clear for people who want to negotiate with the Iranians as to how you go about doing that, with whom do you negotiate, whose word you take at their face value. The third thing is that the Iranians seem to think that as revolutionaries, casualties are not as relevant as probably we would think, or somebody. I mean, basically, it's a revolution, and you should sacrifice your life for a revolution as long as you're trying to achieve the revolutionary aims. And finally, from what I understand, is that they have, in a sense, looked at the experiences of other countries, particularly Iraq, when its own installation was attacked by the Israelis in 1981, it was out of the urban areas on its own in the desert. It was a very easy target. Well, the Iranians have apparently put all of these nuclear facilities, first of all, underground, under a lot of concrete and other such material, and also apparently in densely populated areas, so that if you're going to hit one of these installations, you're not going to kill only 100 or 150, but you might be ending up killing maybe thousands of people for each installation, and as such, it would be difficult for the Israelis or whoever is attacking the installations to actually eliminate them altogether, and then they're going to have a kind of a public relations nightmare.
Do you think you talk about this revolutionary fervor within Iran that would suggest that it's okay to take some casualties, or we might have to take some casualties? But do you think the Iranian people, who seem pretty progressive and longing for maybe a kind of democracy, do you think they share that?
Well, it's not the Iranian people who are going to make that decision. It's the leadership that's going to make that decision. For example, the people in Tehran, the middle classes in Tehran would certainly be very much against this. And in fact, they have been very lukewarm about Iran's pursuit of a nuclear option. It's not them, but it is the leadership which still is imbued with revolutionary fervor. Certainly, since the arrival of Ahmadinejad, that kind of Islamist fervor has been revived, and the leadership is not isolated. I mean, these people have very strong support among the less well-to-do, amongst the poorer urban population, and certainly in the rural population of Iran. I think what happens with Iran is that many of our reporters and journalists go to Iran. They meet with the middle classes, they meet with intellectuals, they meet with newspaper editors, with professors, and so on. And they, in a sense, transmit a message of an Iranian population that is completely contrary to what Ahmadinejad says. And while this is true with that population, this is not the majority of Iranians. These leaders, the revolutionary leaders, the leaders who still believe in the message of Ayatollah Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic, are actually supported. They're supported by a pretty significant section of the Iranian population. And they have created a security and military apparatus that is devoted to them. And so I'm not sure that we can say the Iranian population is against that.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Don't you think on that point? Don't you think that there's a similar problem that we in the West face with dealing with Russia? That obviously, if there's an immediate and imminent military nuclear threat from Iran, it provokes and demands one response. But if one is simply upping the ante and rattling the Iranian cage, as in a sense might happen with the start of a new Cold War in Russia. To a certain extent, it does strengthen authoritarian trends and authoritarian groups within both of these countries. I think that's why the Europeans are very keen to make sure that the American approach, which tends to be always, unfortunately, to go for a military solution, whether it's expansion of NATO or whether it's putting these batteries in Poland and Czech Republic, it's not in the long term going to solve the problem which is posed by a regime in Iran or a government in Russia, which in and of itself needs support from more democratic and more externally oriented elites and populations.
Hmm. All right, 614-292-8513. Perry's our first caller. Hello, Perry.
Oh, I'd just like to have the commentators give their statement about the story in the Washington Post a month ago that Chavez-Sealy has a lobbyist on the payroll for $250,000 who is on McCain's staff for $70,000.
Saakashvili, the president of Georgia.
Yes.
Karen, what do we know about that?
Well, it's been confirmed. you know, one of the features of both campaigns is that they are running against Washington. And one of the things they talk about being broke that needs to be fixed is the pervasiveness of the influence of lobbyists, paid lobbyists, both for domestic causes and for foreign governments. And it is a very important feature of the situation in Washington. So nobody has denied it, and it is true. I think, in fact, he is the only person who's a paid lobbyist for Georgia and Washington.
Mm-hmm. The only person in the whole town?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Well, I think that just aggravates the whole situation.
How so, Perry?
Well, you've got a conflict of interest. We have a man who's running for president who's being advised by a man who's representing a foreign nation.
Hmm.
How can that be anything but a conflict?
Karen DeWisha, what's your thought about that?
I think it is a conflict of interest. And, you know, Adit and I lived in Washington for 15 years, and one of the things that's really observable during presidential election cycles is that everybody becomes a foreign policy advisor to one or another of the campaigns. Now, when you become a paid advisor, that, it seems to me, puts the onus on you to make sure that you don't have conflicts. So, yeah, I think it is a conflict.
Perry, thanks for your call. It's 614-292-8513. We're here with Dennis. Hello, Dennis.
Yes, I had a question, if we could still ask questions about Israel.
Yeah.
I would like to know the opinion of your thoughts on the veracity of Barack Obama's speech in APAC supporting Israel.
You want to know whether Israeli citizens found that speech persuasive or what?
Yes.
Adit, what do we know about Israeli public opinion about Barack Obama?
As far as I know, and I think you really probably should talk to an Israeli commentator on that. Generally speaking, as far as I know, the Israelis tend to support the McCain ticket. They see him as a longstanding pro-Israeli senator. He hasn't veered from that. He has supported all of President Bush's policies toward in the Middle East, much of which is actually pro-Israel. They certainly fear Obama, you know, rightly or wrongly. His name and his middle name is always going to engender some concern amongst Israelis or pro-Israelis. Obama has a past record of ties with radical elements, some of them with ties with Palestinians or with the Arabs and so on. Now, that doesn't mean that he is not pro-Israeli, but when it comes to supporting one or the other, I suppose you always go with the proven product, and McCain is a proven product. So I would be very surprised if the Israelis or the majority of the Israelis would favor an Obama administration against the McCain administration.
Dennis, do you have a follow-up question there?
Well, I appreciate that what you're saying. I was just I thought what Obama was saying about preserving Jerusalem and seeing it as an undivided city was very positive.
Okay, Adid.
Well, he did say that, but I think kind of a week later, I think 4 days later, his campaign came up with certain clarifications about that. So it's not very clear to me that this promise was made. Let's put it this way: it may have been made because he was speaking to AIPAC, the very powerful Israeli lobby in Washington, and realizing that his talk amongst the pro-Israeli Americans, and particularly among the Jewish community in Americans, was not very high. And so he made that kind of statement. Let's not forget that this statement is not even endorsed by the current administration, which is seen as to be one of the most pro-Israeli administrations in the history of the United States. So he made that kind of statement. Everybody actually was very surprised. I mean, it raised a lot of eyebrows to that, but... But there were certain some clarifications after that. So anyway, you take it
okay.
for what it's worth.
Dennis, thanks for your call. Adid, you say that Barack Obama has had ties in the past, some sort of ties with Palestinians or radical Palestinians?
Well, he has had ties with – it's not so much the Palestinians – but certainly he has had ties in Chicago with Americans of Arab origins. The guy who lent him the money and who's now indicted is a Syrian. He certainly has not ties, but there is nothing wrong with that. I mean, Arab Americans are American citizens. And they vote, and they pay their taxes, and by definition, like Jewish Americans, tend to be pro-Palestinian. And Barack Obama, being a state senator in Chicago and an upcoming star in the Democratic Party, has contacts with a whole slew of constituencies, and part of that he would go for fundraisers and so on amongst groups who are Arab Americans or Palestinian Americans. He also has ties with, or at least we now know that he has ties with some radical elements in the 1960s or so 1970s. That doesn't say very much about him at all, because a lot of people have ties with people who were either radicals or whatever in the 1970s.
Yeah, including the mayor, including Richard Daley, the mayor of
exactly,
Chicago.
Exactly. It's very different. It's very different now. What I'm saying is that so for somebody like me, it doesn't mean very much. But if you're an Israeli and you're looking to be absolutely certain that the next president of the United States is committed wholeheartedly to you, these kind of things are going to have an impact on your support for one or the other of the candidates.
Could I just say something there?
Sure.
That I think that, you know, your caller pointed out something. You know, he was very encouraged by Obama's statement in front of AIPAC. But when we talk about what I think ultimately we would have to regard as a gaffe, since he corrected it, Obama's statement that he was in favor of a united Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, you need to remember that no American administration has recognized United Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, and that our embassy is in Tel Aviv, and we have declined the calls by Likud, whether out of power or when they're in power, to recognize Jerusalem as the an undivided Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. After all, half of Jerusalem has been lived in for centuries by an Arab population. So the position of the U.S. government has always been that the final status of Jerusalem must be decided amongst the partners, ultimately, to this conflict, who are unable to recognize each other, unable to negotiate with each other. And this is for them to decide and shouldn't really become a ball in, you know, endless political discussions in the United States. And this is also something that is not agreed to by Israelis themselves. After all, there are many different views on this issue in Israel, and we would never imagine that people on, let's say, the center or the center left in Israel would want anyone to come in and say, well, sorry, but this Likud-backed solution is something that we're going to support, and you no longer have a role in any kind of settlement. Mm-hmm. The parties to the settlement have to decide the end status of Jerusalem. This is the position of all American governments. And I think Obama did make a gaffe there that he later had to correct.
Uh-huh. Karen DeWisha and Adid DeWisha are professors of political science at Miami University here in Ohio at Oxford. 614-292-8513. Emails at openline@wosu.org. Email here from John that says, please make a quick comment on the Putin suggestion, also made by others, that Bush/McCain pushed the Georgian leader into the attack in order to help the Republicans in the upcoming presidential election. Karen, that would be to you, I guess.
Yeah, there have been people, not just Putin, looking for evidence of a green light to the Georgians. Obviously, the Democrats would be amongst them. And we don't have any evidence of that yet. We know that State Department was on the phone to Saakashvili, trying to get him to not be the first to fire. They had been monitoring this conflict throughout the summer. We have lots of statements of ambassadors, American ambassadors, European ambassadors at various meetings saying it looks like, you know, something's going to happen. But I don't think that we could imagine that this is a wag the dog situation. We don't have any evidence of it. And I don't think that we can see it. I prefer to see it, frankly, as an example. I mean, Prime Minister Putin is an extremely intelligent person. I met with him last year, and I mean, we just can't underestimate the intellectual qualities of both Putin and Medvedev. And so there is a certain level of wanting to interfere in the American election, I think, that's going on, and wanting to deflect criticism of the Russian position. But I honestly don't think that we have seen it. I don't think we have the evidence.
All right. Why would they want to interfere in the American election?
Well, they want to first and foremost, they want to deflect international criticism from them. They want to raise this possibility amongst particularly the Western Europeans, who are more than willing to engage in America bashing. I mean, Adid and I lived in England for, in my case, 15 years, in Adid's case, for longer. And, you know, Britons define themselves against America in some kind of fundamental way, and it's always possible for the British, what we call the chattering classes, to criticize America first. And so this is part of the kind of divide Europe strategy on the part of the Russians.
All right, let's go back to our callers here. And Mike, you're on the air. Hello, Mike. Mike, are you here?
Hello, is this me here?
It is you.
Oh, thank you. You know, I'm just an Anglo-Saxon retiree in northern, living in northern Columbus, and I've never heard such a big hoax that it keeps being perpetuated. The media doesn't do anything about it. Iran is not a threat to Poland or Eastern Europe. Iran has never threatened any of Europe. Iran has been hasn't invaded anybody for 1,000 years, as far as I know, and they don't have the weapons that Israel has. They have half the tanks that Israel has. And this hoax that President Bush is perpetuating, that we're going to put $4 billion worth of missiles in Poland to protect from us, protect Poland from Iran, who has no missiles that can reach there, has never intended to be there, and this president of Iran doesn't have authority over the military. It's just a wildest.
Mike, do you see Iran as any potential threat to Israel?
No, because Israel could wipe them out in one day. Israel has 200 nuclear weapons. Iran, if they were going to attack Israel, they would have done it. But they are under-equipped compared to Israel. And for some reason, your professor alluded to this, that maybe we ought to, Israel thinks we ought to attack Iran. We ought to spill blood and fight Israel's wars, when in fact, this president said that Israel, the state of Israel, should be wiped out. He didn't say the people of Israel. Hmm. They don't like a state that's totally Jewish. They think it ought to be a combination. It ought to be a true democracy. Everybody shares.
All right. Adid, your thoughts?
Well, I mean, actually, much of what he says is true. There is no doubt that if there is a war between Iran and Israel, probably Israel will be able to prevail. I agree that they do have, I don't know about 200, but certainly over 100 nuclear warhead. They do have both probably missiles, and also their airplanes can actually be attacked. So in a kind of just an absolute distribution of forces, yes, they have the ability. The point is, I mean, you got to look at this not from the point of view of somebody living here in Ohio, from the comfort of our safe environment here, but from the position of the two combatants. And what I was saying before is that if you're an Israeli, you're not going to take too much comfort by the notion that if they attack us and they with nuclear weapons and they end up wiping out half of our population, we can attack them and wipe out all of their population. You see what I mean?
That's how we coexisted with Russia.
And I mean, if I were an Israeli, quite honestly, given that there are belligerent statements coming from Iran, I would be concerned. Let's put it this way.
Sure, be concerned, but that doesn't mean America should attack Iran.
Well, Mike, thanks for your comments. So in other words, Adid, you're saying, yeah, it's true that Israel may well prevail, but at what incredible cost? Huh?
And the point is that if you're an Israeli policymaker, you cannot sit around comforted by the idea that I might prevail. This is not a very large country with not a very large population. And if you were an Israeli, I can well understand that you are concerned about the belligerent attitude of the Iranians, or certainly of the Iranian president, and their seemingly relentless pursuit of a nuclear option.
Well,
can I also say something?
Yes, Ken, we have 30 seconds. Sure.
That we will definitely, Israel would definitely prevail. The United States would definitely prevail because of the nuclear option, but nobody prevails if nuclear weapons are used.
Yeah,
sure.
Because that's a very small neighborhood, and if Chernobyl caused, you know, unending problems for the population in who were downwind of a single leak, nuclear weapons in that area, in any area, we would say, but they cannot be used. So we have to use deterrence. That's the only possibility.
Karen DeWisha, Adid DeWisha, professors of political science, Miami University. Thanks so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
News is next on WOSU 820 Columbus.